Succession number 27303, Reel 1.
Mr. Harry Garrett, Reel 1.
Well, my name is Harry Garrett. I was born on the 27th of April 1918 in Uxbridge, Middlesex. I had a very happy start of my life, but it got a bit tedious later on. When we were aged four, we had moved to Broccoli in London, South East London. And we lived in this big house, and we had problems. My poor father, he was dreadfully ill. He actually died 3 years later, and he had heart trouble, and mother couldn't contain us three children. So I was sent off to Dr. Bernardo's homes, which I stayed there for between 3 and 4 years, which I enjoyed immensely, and enjoyed every minute I was there, funny enough. I eventually came out after about 6 months. We were back in again to another home at Norwood Children's Home. Again, a most wonderful home, a very nice people. They looked after us, and we were very, very happy there. Came home again there, and then I was about 13 at the time, I believe, yes, and got home to my mother and father, and my father had seriously ill, he died. And mother had to keep us. She couldn't keep us because we didn't get no money. We had to go down to the Deptford Broadway to get 10 shillings for the food to keep us going. I went in this lovely home, and this was at Sidcup, near Sidcup Station, a very nice place in Kent. I stayed there till I was about 14, and I came out, went to live down at Lewisham, with my mother, over the top of the butcher shop. We stayed there for a while, and then I went to work at 14 as a shoe repairing boy in the shop next door, and I used to help to mend shoes, principally sum of 14 shillings a week, which helped the family to survive. And I used to take more money, I think, on tips, because I delivered the shoes all around the different houses, and a paper round, I had a paper round, I used to earn, I think, it's about 6 shillings a week, I think, yes, about 6 shillings a week, Sunday as well. That was very good. That all went in the kitty for mother. Eventually, I was at a very, very kind aunt. Actually, she was a friendly aunt. She's actually one of the Bourbons in France. Had she been a man, this lady would have been a prince or king of Bourbon, so I understand. And they looked after me. She mothered me, this woman, and she was thought the world of me, and I thought the world of her. They looked after me with her brother, and from there on I sort of progressed a bit. I went to the city in London, and I also joined a nice firm called Robert Craig and Sons, who does all the paperwork and envelopes and paper. I didn't particularly like the job because it was very boring. So I saw an advert one day in the paper that an office boy needed in a millinery warehouse in Charterhouse Square in the city. So I thought I'd go and have a go at this here. I walked in, and the governor said to me, "Ah," he said, "well, Mr. Collett had to see you." He was the boss of the firm. And he said to me, "Well, Gary," he said, "can you start right away?" I said, "Well, no, sir, I can't really leave a firm like this all suddenly." So he said, "Well, when can you start? Tomorrow?" And I said, "No, sir." I said, "I can come in Monday." "Very good," he said. "Come in Monday," he said. "If you're no good," he said, "we'll kick you out." I stayed there for 42 years. But then, of course, the war came along. But
just
before,
just before you start in the war, could you just say how many children in your family?
Oh, yeah. My family actually consists of mother, my younger brother Kenny, and my sister Peggy. Unfortunately, they've both passed away now. But they were good. We were very good friends, very happy family, and very loyal to our mother. I suppose we should have been.
Were they with you in the Bernardo's home?
No, we were in a separate home. My sister was with me in the Sidcup homes, and my brother as well. The first home I went to in the Doc Bernardo's, my brother went to Devon, and my sister went to Staffordshire. So it was a long way away from each other. But the family was really split up, because in those days, the care wasn't worried about the children. That, you know, you unfortunately looked after you if you could. We used to do lots of things. I've not put in that letter. When my father was alive, he was in the trouble too with our family, and we got pushed out of our house because we couldn't afford rent. And we used to travel on the 46 and 72 trams all night, sixpence all night, and threepence all night for children, travelling all up to Shepherd's Bush on the trams, sleeping on the trams. And we, two or three times, we stopped in Salvation Army homes and houses, looked after us, and then benevolent people would put us up for the night. And I stayed in Rowton House, which is a tramps house in the West End, and also one at Deptford. But then eventually, I say this happened all before I went to Blackheath. This was a lady friend of mine.
Just looking back on being in, you know, having to go into the children's homes, do you think it did you any harm?
It did me the world of good. It taught me respect. Yes, sir. Yes, madam. I still would say yes, ma'am, and yes, madam. And a lot of people say, you need to call me madam. But I feel it's part of the duty of anybody. And I was taught to believe in God, which was a good thing. I was taught all sorts of sports. And I really enjoyed the life. I put myself into it without any worry about home life. It didn't bother me. So I settled down very well in every home I went into. I enjoyed it. I joined the Territorials in 1938 with my brother. I'd bought a tandem in Lewisham, and we used to cycle to London every day on this tandem, and the 6.5-7 miles just take us 20 minutes on the tandem, my brother and I. And we used that, and suddenly I said to Ken, they tell me there's a good chance of a new unit in the British Army, anti-tank gunners. It's a lot of fun. I said, let's join, Ken. So yeah, why shouldn't we? And I went to Brixton one night, and we signed up, and I became a Territorial soldier. It was a wonderful feeling again, and the escort, the real comradeship of all these boys was absolutely great. And I really enjoyed that life. We used to go to camp, and we'd get £5,000 a year. I think they get about 1,500 a day. But we enjoyed it. Money didn't seem to worry in those days. I'd never had any money, and everything that was given to me or I did, I've appreciated things throughout the world. And this was one of the things I think at the back of me still. You like friendship more than money, you see. But I suppose a few bob would be helped now and again. But then, of course, we went to Oakhampton down in Devon. And while we were there, we were called up, mobbed up,
enlisted?
Well, almost an enlistment then, because the war was imminent. The war hadn't been declared, but we were taken in. So we came to Brixton, back to Brixton where our battery was, and we got all our kits and all things ready, and I went home and said goodbye to my friends and all my relatives there at home. and my lovely girl, who was my fiancée, Ethel, and away we went to Cherbourg, to Southampton. My mother and my fiancée came down with us on the train, and they all waved goodbye, a very tearful goodbye. But then, of course, it was so young, I was only 21, and you felt it was an expedition was going to be worthwhile your while, because I was looking forward to the war, funny enough. I don't know why, but you saw so many things happening in the world which you didn't want to happen, and you thought, well, if we've got to go, we've got to go. And so I landed at Southampton, and we got on this troop ship over to France, to Cherbourg. And the I think this was the vital point of the transport, was from Southampton to Cherbourg up to the Belgian frontier. That's where it was all being done. And the trip to Cherbourg, you can almost call it like the M1, because there's ship upon ship upon ship trying to get into Cherbourg Harbour, unload the vehicles, the guns and all that sort of thing, and the men. And we were sort of, I was off the Isle of Wight for 2 nights before we even got over there, you see.
What date? Do you have the date fixed in your mind?
Okay. The 20th of November, and we went over there, and on the way over, I was on watch on the ship, and I got a terrific pain in my back. And I went to see the MO, and he said, I think you've got pleurisy. When we get to France, he said, we'll have to see what we can do for you. So when the ship landed, everybody got all their kit off, and I went to the MO, and he said, we're sending you to the Cherbourg General Hospital. It was a big 2,000-bedded hospital, massive place, and I was in there for 3 weeks altogether. It wasn't a major attack, it was just a very bad feeling of pain, I suppose.
So the pain was mainly in your...
In my lung, yeah.
Right.
So, in this... because it's so amazing when you go into a place like that. I've never been in a hospital in my life until then. And there's all these big nun hats, there's nurses with the big hats on in there. But they treat us, oh, fantastic. And all the boys are eating their bully beef and biscuits, and we're having chicken and all that sort of food, and being pampered and looked after. And I'm palled up with a chap called Jimmy James, which I'll introduce you later on. And he was a great guy. And when I was going to discharge, I said, Jimmy, I said, I'm off to Lille tomorrow. So he said, oh, he said, I'm going as well, Harry. I said, oh, good, we can go together. So we got together, and away we went on the train. We got up there, went to Ambrings, and up to Lille. And I said, well, bye-bye, Jim. I said, God bless you. Hope you get through the war okay and things. And I got to my battery, and it was stationed in a marvellous chateau at a place called... We got to this place at Lambassar, which was a chateau. Most beautiful place, in lovely gardens and lakes. It was an absolute treasure. And we used to go fishing in the lakes there for the fish and eat the fish and all sorts of things. And eventually, of course, we did lots of training in France on different schemes, and we were getting, obviously, the attacks by the German fighter planes, because there was no real war started, only a bit of a skirmish in the Maginot Line.
Harry, would you talk about the training? Because at the IWM, they like to know a bit more about training.
Oh, the training?
What it entailed.
What in...
How it...
Oh, well, our training was, once I got to France, we were told that the Belgians would not allow us in because they wanted to be neutral. So we made gun position from the Maginot Line right up to the coast. And where my battery was stationed, we did lovely gun pits, you know. I was an anti-tank gunner, by the way.
Did you just give your regiment as well?
Yes, I was in the 52nd... I was in 142 battery of this regiment. And we were digging gun pits and training. We're on schemes. night patrols up to the line and back, and out in the country mostly, but we were stabilised well back from the actual fighting that was going on there at the time. But we obviously had to, there were so many troops there, so you had to have your ACAC positions, and I was in charge, at least I wasn't in charge, I was in a bunch of five chaps, and we had two Bren guns in a gun pit that we made out. We did the watch every day, you know, and as soon as the Jerry plane came over, we used to let fly and fired it. I don't think we did any good or any harm, but never mind. And then suddenly we'd heard that the Germans had broken through to, and we were on the coast where we were. We wasn't far from Tournai. So we got all kitted up, ready to go through. And we went through Tournai just after it had been bombed, and it was a terrible sight we saw there. It was people lying about all around in the town, you know. It was, they killed about 500 people, I believe. It was a dreadful sight, see. Obviously, it was just sporadic stuff, just coming through, dropping a bomb and flying off. And then we got through on the roads to Tournai. And when we got through, we couldn't move on half the roads because all the civilian people in Belgium were on the roads getting out or getting in or trying to move or move out, and we had a big job getting through.
Had they packed up their homes? Had they had all their possessions with them as well?
Yes, just barrows and carts and horses and bags on their back, old women with bags, and it was a very pathetic sight. And then we made our way as far as we could, right through. Sometimes we had to deviate from the roads because of the people on it. And two or three times on the way, we were strafed by the Germans. And they didn't care who they killed. I mean, it was mostly civilians that got killed, not the soldiers.
How were you travelling?
I was in a truck, towing the gun, my two-pound anti-tank gun. Right. And we got through to them, and we stopped once or twice to help the poor people. There were terrible sights there were. Eventually we got to the Albert Canal just outside Brussels, and we were told to stand and hold this canal against any German odds that came through. Well, we had made a couple of shoots, but nothing serious, and then we suddenly saw the guards coming through, and the officer of the guard said to us, "What are you doing here?" So we said, "Well, we've got to hold this bridge." He said, "Well, we've been told to move because the Germans are behind us. There's about four or five divisions or something like this." So my bombardier said, Sergeant Grover said, "We've heard nothing." So he got in touch with an officer, and he said, "Well, perhaps you better move off." So we packed our guns, and away went back to Lille on the way. And again, we had the carnage of the civilians on the road and all this sort of thing. You people don't understand. It was really a terrible sight to see women and children screaming and babies being killed and blown to pieces by these machine guns and people. You live it through it,
yeah.
And it's all, to me, it's all just a picture now. But I did feel very, very sorry for people. But of course, we had a job to do, and we couldn't stop and help them. So we got back to Lille, and then we were told to go right down to Arras, Amiens, and on to the Vimy Ridge, where we held a gun position in Vimy Ridge because the Germans were supposed to be attacking from the east coming through. And we just got into the cemetery, and the Germans were firing at us with their machine guns, and we actually, it was a fixed line of firing, funny enough. We were on a road by the cemetery, and the shells were coming over, and all the stones of our little old 1914-18 boys were blown up and all that sort of thing, but of course you can't help that sort of thing. And I said to my mates, I said, "Come on," I said, "let's get out of here quickly." So we moved out quickly across the road. And then we got our orders to make back to Dunkirk. We heard about this because we've been skirmishing. We've been had skirmishes all the way, by the way, in the period. I mean, it sounds like a minute, but there's about a fortnight of fighting we did, going here, going there, and every action was a quick business because we were really overwhelmed with Jerry's, because wherever we went to, we had been bombed and shelled and all round, you know, and move. And of course, then the Operation Dynamo came about, that we've got to make our way to Dunkirk.
What guns did you have at that stage?
A 2-pounder, little shell that big, that wide. It was an anti-tank gun. At the time, we used to. Lord Gort came to see us, by the way. Well, I was on the range down at Lydd one day, and I think we beat the regular army by about 3 seconds, the territorial. We were so keen, I suppose. He said, "Jolly good shooting, you chaps, jolly good shooting." And then, of course, we're knocking the tanks to pieces down there. They're made of plywood and cardboard, you see. But when we got into the actual action itself, well, on the way back to Dunkirk, as I say, we're having sporadic fighting all the way, but it was mostly being shelled and bombed. The Germans were sort of chasing us up, and we landed in a one little place, and we housed inside a big barn that was full of straw, and we was hiding from the enemy. The guns and all that were in there, out the way. And I remember this quite another. The Junkers 88 bomber came across. I could have almost put my hand up to touch it. I could have shot it down, easy. But because in a barn full of men and straw, I thought the first thing's going to happen there, we're going to hit that, we're all going to fry. And we let it go. And then we carried on there, up as far as a certain area. I can't remember half the names, of course. And one morning, I was on duty, guard duty. We were always on guard duty. I mean, you didn't dare sleep because there was so much going on. And suddenly I heard tanks, and I shouted out to the bombardier. I said, "Bombardier, tell the sergeant he's on tanks." So he went to tell him, and he made us all stand to. He said, "My orders are that if any tank approaches you with their guns forward, they must be German. If the guns are pointing aft, they are friendly." So this morning, it came along, we heard these, we're all trembling, all frightened out of our life, because in the dark, you hear this terrible noise of clanking, 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 and you know it's death on wheels, or tracks. And it was coming up, and I think there's about, 300, 400 yards away, and my sergeant said, "They're Germans, the guns are pointing towards. Open fire." So I got my gun and I kept firing. I was a layer on the gun at the time. I banged up, because you could fire bang, bang, as quick as that. You know, we got a good layer, put the shells in, bang, and hit. I hit the tank, and I kept seeing my shells flying off it. And then they opened up with their 75mm guns on this tank, and that we had a lot of casualties all around the area then. Guns were knocked over, people were being blown about, and eventually the firing ceased. And this officer in the tank had come up, he said, "Pardon, monsieur, I thought you were the Germans." It was French. And these tanks were the biggest tanks I've ever seen in my life. We're an average tank in the army today is about 50 tons. This one then weighed about 100 tons. It was massive, and there was nothing to stop it. I mean, I think myself, and I keep saying this to myself, had we been allowed into Belgium instead of stuck on the border, we could be in front of the guns at Liège, which was almost imaginary line in itself, and the French as well. And if they'd opened up the fire on the Germans then, I'm sure the opposition we gave them would have made a big difference, that war. As it was, we've been chased about. We couldn't settle down to anything. So eventually, after this horrible skirmish, we tied it up, all our men that were wounded. and away we went to Dunkirk.
So your guns were more or less ineffective against
absolutely,
those tanks?
Absolutely. I hit a track on this, but I think I damaged it, but I don't think it did much good. It still kept going on.
But how did you feel? I mean, how did you feel to know that...
Excited and frightened.
No, I mean about the friendly fire.
Well, afterwards we were very sad, and so was the officer. He thought we were Germans, you see. Because the Germans were all around us at any time before we got to Dunkirk. And I think you can say they could be anywhere. And he thought we were Germans. So he was in his right and accept the fact that he was coming forward with his guns pointing forward instead of back. Had he done that, we would never have fired on him, you see. But, my bombardier, he shot him right. Oh, he was very badly killed. He was a poor man, all a nice chap. Then, as I say, we went on then, and we got within about 15 miles of Dunkirk, and we were stopped by military police and officers saying that we have got to make to the beaches. We held a position outside Dunkirk for a while, but orders from General Franklin, who was the commander of Y Division, that we've got to make our way back to England through Dunkirk. So we went to the side where the canal was, and we dumped the gun in the tank, in the river, in the tank. The trucks that we had, we emptied the oil out of the sump and kept the engines running so that it all seized up. And now you saw nothing else but lorries on fire, tanks on fire, motorbikes being thrown in the river, and the whole thing was absolutely chaos. You cannot believe. It was maddening. It was maddening. Think, you young men, you'd not even done a bit of the war you were supposed to do. You'd been chased all the way. And it was most amazing when you think about this. And then we got to the base, and my brother, by the way, was with me all this time. He was in a different troop, but in the same battery.
This is your brother Ken.
My brother Ken. And Ebby Lee, my dear friend, we kept together. And I said, come on, we've got to get back to the beach. Well, we eventually got to the beach, and we walked along to the mole. And I think I must have been about 200 yards from the actual mole.
Could you explain what a mole is?
Oh, the mole is a small pier coming out to the sea. There was a pier in effect, which was being badly bombed and shelled by the Germans. And most of the casualties in the ships were up there. But the mole looked like about probably half a mile away this way. And that was a wooden construction done by wood. And that's where we must have been 200 yards from there. So I said, look, Ken, I said, look at this lot in the water. I said, we'll never get out there. Look, they're all up to their necks in water, trying to get the boats. There's all the bombing going on, the shelling going on. And you think, oh, this is not for us. Come on, son. I said, we're going to dig a trench. So we got up near the little roadway, and we dug a trench, filled it with boxes, and so it wouldn't, fall in on top of us. And we settled down, and I said, look, Ken, we've got to find some food or do something. I said, now, look, we've got to stay here. It's no good. We'll wait until we see a boat that we can get onto, and then we'll go go away. So I said, well, look, I'm off to see what we can do. Now, I was always a good scrounger. So I said, Ken, you look up. No, Bebby, I said, look after the trench, Bebby, I said, because it's ours. So away I went, and I got this sort of wooden barn door, and I opened it up, smashed the door up, and it was all locked. And I cannot believe that after all the evacuation which had been going on, this place was like a dead end's cave. There was jars and jars of neat Jamaica rum, which is like a it's not like a liquid, it's almost like a gluey gum. So we picked up two of those, and I went outside, and there's lots of lads lying around, of course, because the whole place had been... I got about half a dozen water bottles, chucked out any contents, and we filled six water bottles with this glue. And inside, apart from that, there was cases and cases of carnation milk, biscuits. I couldn't find any bully beef. I did find one. And then Norton and BSA motorbikes in there. Absolutely brand new, never been taken out. So I called my brother over, because he helped us. We got half a crate of milk, and I took these water bottles over, and I said, we want water, we can get it. We just can't get any water. We couldn't get anywhere. So eventually, I said, well, there's only one thing, Ken. I said, you've heard this rum and milk business, haven't you? So we put this rum in our mess tin. I still have mess tins, by the way. And put the milk in, mixed the milk up, and we had rum and milk. And as I say this, quite honestly, I think we're the bravestly on the beach after about an hour. But we didn't overdo it, because you've got to keep your brains okay. And it was most amazing, really. Now then, the next day, don't forget, all the time on the beaches, we've been strafed, machine guns, the dive bombers were coming down, you know. And when they come down, they come straight down your throat, it seems. And we did see two or three goes. We saw them dive down and went straight in the sand and the sea. They never came out of